Hello, and welcome to Beautiful Losers of History, Episode 4, A Nation Divided. Last episode, we explored the social and political forces within the newly independent United States of America. The generation of Americans that followed the generation of the Founding Fathers will be influenced by these forces when they wield political power in the years leading up to the Indian Removal Act of 1830. On one side, you had a group called the Federalists, who wanted a strong national government led by aristocrats whose only interest was the well-being of the nation. Shockingly, though, the public did not want to be ruled by aristocrats who thought they were above everyone else, so on the other side, you had the Anti-Federalists. Anti-Federalists had opposed the creation of the United States Constitution and wanted a weak national government with most political power delegated to the states. Besides these political divisions, the early United States experienced rapid developments in society that created intense anxiety amongst the population. Old social ties and traditions seemed to disappear, and everybody was scrambling to understand their new place in this new country. Commerce and population boomed, but so did violence and alcoholism. For this episode, I'm going to return to the Cherokee Nation and the man at the center of our narrative, the Ridge. Like the Americans, the Cherokee will face their own internal divisions in response to the rapid pace of change within their nation. These divisions will be inflamed by the United States, which will continue to bribe Cherokee leaders for land, but at the same time, the American and Cherokee nations will become even more intertwined with one another. The Cherokee will look to the United States as a model when developing their own government, and they will seek out American President Thomas Jefferson to mediate between their own internal factions. Before we begin, though, I want to take a brief moment to discuss my sources for this episode. I am relying heavily on John Ellie's Trail of Tears, The Rise and Fall of the Cherokee Nation, Thurman Wilkins' Cherokee Tragedy, The Ridge Family and the Decimation of a People, and The History of the Indian Tribes of North America by Thomas McKinney and James Hall. Also, just a reminder, the best way to keep up with this podcast is to subscribe to it in your podcast app. Not only will you get the latest episodes when I publish them, but you'll also help Beautiful Losers of History attract new listeners because podcasting platforms promote shows that have a healthy pool of subscribers. So don't be shy. Go ahead and click the subscribe button in your podcast app. I'll give you a few seconds. Are you ready? Good. Now that housekeeping is out of the way, let's get on with the show. I ended the episode before last with the murder of a Cherokee chief named Doublehead. Doublehead had sold Cherokee lands in Tennessee to Americans for bribes, and he was often violent and cruel to his own people. So nobody was particularly upset about his death. To the contrary, many people welcomed it. Most Cherokee people, that is. Return Jonathan Meigs Sr. was probably the only person in Cherokee country who mourned Doublehead. Meigs was born in 1740 in the British colony of Connecticut, and he was a veteran of the Revolutionary War when he achieved the rank of colonel. After the war, Colonel Meigs, like many Americans, headed west, where he worked as a land speculator in the Northwest Territory in modern-day Ohio. He then got involved in local politics until 1801 when he moved south to Tennessee and became the U.S. Indian agent to the Cherokee Nation. Indian agents were officials authorized to negotiate and interact with Indian tribes on behalf of the U.S. government, so you can think of them as quasi-ambassadors to Indian nations. Meigs was the man who negotiated with and bribed Doublehead, and he lamented the chief's death. Doublehead had been a reliable partner for the United States government. He was easy to bribe, which made him easy to work with. Meigs was responsible for maintaining good relations between the United States and the Cherokee Nation. But just as, if not more importantly, he was tasked with acquiring Cherokee territory, and now his main negotiating partner was dead. And he was surprised to find out that the man who murdered Doublehead, a young chief named The Ridge, was celebrated rather than condemned for it. Meigs didn't know what to think of The Ridge. He was a rising political star on the Cherokee National Council, and he was becoming wealthier every year, but much to the chagrin of Meigs, none of his wealth came from bribes. The Ridge was developing a reputation as a man who could not be bought, which would make Meigs' job more difficult. By 1807, when Doublehead was killed, Meigs had been an Indian agent to the Cherokee for 6 years, and in that short time, he was one of the few white people to witness firsthand the rapid developments in Cherokee society. Industrious men, like the Ridge, were giving up the Cherokee tradition of leaving home for months at a time to hunt big game, and instead were setting up prosperous farms and small businesses, such as trading posts, inns, and ferry services across rivers. Meigs also witnessed the Cherokee establish a kind of police force that roamed the nation and maintained peace in punished crimes. The territory that still belonged to the Cherokee was roughly the size of Cuba, so this was no easy feat. In English, this police force was called the Light Horse Brigade. The Ridge commanded the Light Horse Brigade alongside his political patron, a Cherokee man named James Van, though, in Meigs' opinion, Van was half mad. Van was one of the richest Cherokee in the nation, and, according to Meigs, he was constantly paranoid about losing his wealth. When Van led the Light Horse Brigade, he frequently beat men and women at the slightest provocation, sometimes to the point of death. In his letters to Washington, D.C., Meigs wrote that he thought these beatings peculiar. It had never been Cherokee custom to beat people as punishment, he wrote. This was a new development spearheaded by Van after an increase in theft in the nation. Theft, too, was a strange development, Meigs wrote. He could recall a time when stealing was non-existent among the Cherokee, unless it was from strangers, such as a rival nation or white travelers. Meigs wrote that most thieves were poor, full-blooded Cherokee who were starving and driven to desperation by the disappearance of big game. As American territory expanded, there were fewer and fewer large animals to be hunted, which meant that the Cherokee who followed the traditional ways of life were increasingly destitute. It was only the Cherokee who adapted to these changes, people like the Ridge, who prospered. I talk a lot about politics and economic development in the Cherokee Nation in this podcast, because when the fight over the Indian Removal Act happens, these developments will be cited by defenders of Indian sovereignty and ignored by proponents of Indian removal. One of the main arguments people made in support of Indian removal was that the indigenous people of the continent were so hopelessly backwards that they needed to be sent as far away as possible so that they could live their simple, backwards lives far from the corrupting influence of modernity found in the United States. As I hope I'm making clear, this argument is complete bunk. The Cherokee Nation embraced modernity, and men like the Ridge grew as prosperous as any American. But many Cherokee who were not able to adapt as well as the Ridge had become impoverished. This parallels a similar phenomenon going on in Europe and America at the same time, where the Industrial Revolution was in full effect. Overall, countries were getting richer, but the number of individual people living in poverty grew. I say all of this because though our narrative may center on the Ridge, I want you to understand that most Cherokee did not share his good fortune, just like most Americans did not live as well as George Washington or Thomas Jefferson. But the plight of these impoverished Cherokee was of little consequence to Colonel Meigs. Quite the contrary, it made his job easier. The Cherokee still held vast territory stretching from northern Alabama and Georgia through central Tennessee to the western edges of North Carolina. The Cherokee population in the early 1800s was estimated to be between 10,000 and 20,000 people, so the vast majority of this land was unsettled, and it was used by the Cherokee for hunting expeditions. If there were no animals to hunt, that meant it would be far easier for Meigs to persuade the Cherokee to surrender what was, in his view, excess territory. Doublehead's murder put a wrinkle in this plan. But to Meigs' delight, he could still find chiefs willing to sell Cherokee lands for the right price, and a well-placed bribe. After Doublehead's death, Meigs approached the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, a man whose Cherokee name was Enoli or Enali, but in English he was known as Black Fox. Chief Black Fox told Meigs that he was willing to continue Doublehead's land sales as long as he got his cut. So it was that in September 1807, Black Fox agreed to sell Cherokee territory in central Tennessee for the price of $2,000 up front, followed by an annual payment for 4 years of an additional $2,000. This money was meant to be distributed among the Cherokee Nation. Black Fox himself was paid $1,000 plus $100 annually for life, as well as a new rifle thrown in for good measure. He had also convinced a few other prominent chiefs to accept bribes in exchange for endorsing this treaty. In a rather cynical letter, Meigs wrote that the price of the bribes was well worth it for the hell that the chiefs would get from their fellow Cherokee once the news of the sale broke. And hell they got. The nation was in an uproar over the land sale. Most people had thought that Doublehead's death would stop the sale, but to the dismay of everyone, the National Council was just as corruptible as the dead chief. Besides these shady land deals, there was internal Cherokee discord over the annual payments that the United States government made to the nation. Specifically, the upper towns accused the leaders of the lower towns of keeping the entire annuity for themselves and their followers when it was supposed to be distributed among the entire nation evenly. I mentioned in the first two episodes that a schism had emerged between what we call the Cherokee upper towns and the lower towns. The upper towns were closer to the American border and more engaged with trade and commerce with the Americans. They tended to favor friendly relations as a result. By contrast, the lower towns were further away from the frontier, and they rejected modern developments in favor of more traditional ways of life. Until recently, the chiefs of the lower towns had taken a more militant approach to the United States, preferring to limit contact with American society whenever possible. These are all generalizations, mind you. The upper towns and lower towns were far more similar than they were different, but their differences were becoming more pronounced. By the time this episode takes place, in 1808, the lower towns were the dominant faction in national politics. Chief Black Fox, the reigning principal chief, was from the lower towns, as was Chief Doublehead, that is, until the Ridge killed him. And if you remember, old Chief Dragon Canoe from episode 1 founded the lower towns in the 1780s so that his followers could distance themselves from the Americans. Paradoxically, or rather, hypocritically, despite leading the anti-American faction, both Doublehead and Black Fox happily accepted bribes and sold land to the Americans. So you can see why the upper towns were fed up with the lower towns, even before they accused the lower town leadership of withholding the annuity payments from the United States government. The upper towns were frustrated by this political isolation, so they sent a delegation to Washington, D.C. to bring their complaints to President Thomas Jefferson personally. Jefferson listened to the representatives and expressed his sympathy, but he told them that the distribution of the payments was an internal Cherokee affair. Once the U.S. Indian agent handed over the funds to an official Cherokee representative, there was nothing that the United States could do, Jefferson said. Seeing that they could expect no hope to the end of their political isolation, the delegation next proposed a measure so radical it even surprised Jefferson. There are no records of the words exchanged at this meeting. All we have to go by is a letter that Jefferson wrote to the Cherokee Nation describing the meeting, but it was a bombshell. According to Jefferson, the Upper Town delegation requested American support to divide the Cherokee Nation into two, separating the Upper Towns from the Lower Towns. They asked the United States to then annex the Upper Towns and grant the Cherokee living there full American citizenship. As Jefferson described it, quote, "You propose, my children, that your nation shall be divided into two, and that your part, the Upper Cherokees, shall be separated from the Lower by a fixed boundary, shall be placed under the government of the U.S., become citizens thereof, and be ruled by our laws, in time to be our brothers instead of our children," end quote. Now, this is where being an amateur historian can be incredibly frustrating. The Upper Town proposal seems to come out of left field, but if Jefferson's description is accurate, it speaks to how intense the internal division of the Cherokees were that the Upper Towns would rather throw their lot in with the Americans than with their fellow Cherokee. Unfortunately, Jefferson's letter is the only record we have of this proposal, so we can only guess how serious it was. There is no documentation of what the Upper Town delegation proposed in their own words, so it's possible Jefferson misunderstood, which was not uncommon in U.S. Indian negotiations. Were the Upper Cherokee proposing an immediate annexation, or were they just proposing a division so that they could receive their share of the annuity, leaving any theoretical annexation for the future? Or was it just a hypothetical they employed to communicate how powerless they felt under the rule of the Lower Towns? These are the kind of mysteries that are lost to time, and we can only imagine the reasons behind such a proposal. But whatever the reasons, Jefferson didn't seem to consider immediate annexation and citizenship as a serious possibility. In his own words, he wrote, quote, "My children, I shall rejoice to see the day when the red men, our neighbors, become truly one people with us, enjoying all the rights and privileges we do, and living in peace and plenty as we do, without anyone to make them afraid. But are you prepared for this? Have you the resolution to leave off hunting for your living, to lay off a farm for each family to itself, to live by industry, the men working that farm with their hands, raising stock or learning trades as we do, and the women spinning and weaving clothes for their husbands and children? All this is necessary before our laws can suit you or be of any use to you," end quote. In short, Jefferson didn't believe that the Cherokee were prepared to become United States citizens. To his credit, he did say that any division of Cherokee territory would have to be mutually agreed upon by all Cherokees, including the lower towns. But his lack of enthusiasm for what appears to be a golden opportunity for America to obtain more Indian lands is perplexing. After all, America had been slicing off pieces of Indian territory for nearly two decades, and now a delegation was offering up a piece of land on their own volition, with the only requisite being their receiving U.S. citizenship. I can only surmise that this expectation of citizenship is why Jefferson passed on the proposal. It was the upper town's only requirement, so it seems Jefferson wanted the Cherokee land, just without any Cherokee living on it. Based on his own words that I just quoted, Jefferson thought that the Cherokee were a violent, hunting-based society, unfamiliar with farming and the rule of law. As we know, this stereotypical perception was widely held by Americans, even as the Cherokee were in the midst of a political and cultural revolution where they embraced these very activities. But crafty man that he was, Jefferson saw an opportunity to take advantage of the internal Cherokee discord. He directed Colonel Meigs, the Indian agent to the Cherokee, to encourage Cherokees who did not want to become farmers to move to lands west of the Mississippi River, where there was still big game and no American presence. According to Jefferson, the United States would be kind enough to cover the moving cost of the Cherokee who went west, and in exchange, the United States would annex the territory they left behind. Though, unlike the proposal by the upper towns, in this scenario, Jefferson would be able to have Cherokee land without any Cherokee people. Jefferson's proposal is a turning point in our story. It's the earliest example I could find of a U.S. president proposing to remove Indians from the east to new lands in the west. This idea will grow in popularity, and it will finally be realized by the passage of the Indian Removal Act in 1830. But for now, it's just the seed of an idea, and it was at the bottom of Jefferson's priority list. In a letter to Colonel Meigs, Jefferson's Secretary of War, Henry Dearborn, said that Meigs should encourage the Cherokee to consider moving west if they were not inclined to take up farming. But still, he insisted that they should not be pressured to move, and it should be a personal decision among individual Cherokee. So, though Jefferson encouraged migration, I want to emphasize that it was so dissimilar from the future Indian Removal Act, which enforced removal by the barrel of a gun, that I don't want you to think that they're the same policy. But the idea will grow and become more extreme over time. Colonel Meigs received Jefferson's instructions and promoted the idea of removal to Chief Black Fox and his closest allies on the National Council. Meigs was so successful that Black Fox secretly appointed a new delegation to travel to Washington to negotiate the removal of the Cherokee and the sale of their lands more seriously. No doubt Black Fox would be paid handsomely if this proposal came to fruition. All he had to do was convince the council to go along with it. In autumn 1808, he sprung his plan on the National Council. In a speech, Black Fox said, quote, "Tell our great father, the president, that our game has disappeared, and we wish to follow it to the West. We are his friends, and we hope he will grant our petition, which is to remove our people towards the setting sun. But we shall give up a fine country, fertile in soil, abundant in watercourses, and well adapted for the residence of white people. For all this, we must have a good price." End quote. The Cherokee in attendance were stunned. According to McKinney and Hall, Black Fox took advantage of the shocked audience by calling for an immediate vote before an opposition could be formed. A dead silence followed. But then the Ridge stood up. He looked around at the old men who were supposed to be the leaders of the nation, and he saw them sitting quietly. He was said to be disgusted by this passivity and addressed the council in a speech which had such an impact, I will read it to you in full. "My friends," the Ridge said, "you have heard the talk of the principal chief. He points to the region of the setting sun as the future habitation of this people. As a man, he has a right to give his opinion, but the opinion he has given as the chief of this nation is not binding. It was not formed in council in the light of day, but was made up in a corner to drag this people, without their consent, from their own country to the dark land of the setting sun. I resist it here in my place as a man, as a chief, as a Cherokee, having the right to be consulted in a manner of such importance. What are your heads placed on your bodies for but to think? And if to think, why should you not be consulted? I scorn this movement as a few men to unsettle the nation and trifle with our attachment to the land of our forefathers. Look abroad over the face of this country. along the rivers, the creeks, and the branches, and you behold the dwellings of the people who repose in content and security. Why is this grand scheme projected to lead away to another country, the people who are happy here? I, for one, abandon my respect for the will of a chief and regard only the will of thousands of our people. Do I speak without the response of any heart in this assembly, or do I speak as a free man, to men who are free and know their rights? I pause to hear. Immediately, the National Council burst into cheers of support before the Ridge could even sit down. It was clear that Black Fox's proposal was dead on arrival. The Council was so incensed into action that it deposed Black Fox on the spot. Now, I've got to admit that the Ridge's speech and its response sounds a tad Hollywood to me. The fact that we have an English-language transcription is suspect, seeing as he delivered the speech in the Cherokee language, but McKinney and Hall's account was sourced from first-person observers, so even if the exact words are wrong, the sentiment seems accurate. An issue of the Cherokee Phoenix, a future newspaper of the nation that will play a role in future episodes, recalled this council meeting 2 decades later and said representatives of 40 towns opposed Black Fox's proposal. So whatever the exact order of events was, what we do know is that the proposal to uproot the nation to lands west of the Mississippi River went over like a lead balloon. After Black Fox was deposed and the proposal rejected, the council decided to send a more balanced delegation to Washington, D.C., one that would represent all interests of the nation, between both the upper and the lower towns. 6 ambassadors were selected to make this trip, and the Ridge was one of them. I've mentioned this before, but long-distance travel, before railroads, made for a long, hard journey. There were no paved roads, and only an expert scout could navigate the trails through the wilderness. You could travel for days in some areas without encountering another human being. The Cherokee delegation traveled by horseback, starting their journey along the Georgia Road, which I mentioned in Episode 2, that connected Savannah, Georgia, and Knoxville, Tennessee, and cut through Cherokee territory. They made their way north, traveling through Greenville, South Carolina, and then through North Carolina via Salem. And side note, Salem was the home of the Moravians, the German Christian sect whose missionaries established the first school in the Cherokee Nation, which I discussed in Episode 2. After North Carolina, the delegation continued north through Virginia, passing by Jefferson's home of Monticello. Finally, in December 1808, the Cherokee delegation arrived at the American capital. All total, the journey likely took 3 to 4 weeks. Washington, D.C. is on a low-lying marshland along the Potomac River on the border between Virginia and Maryland. It was technically founded in 1790, but the federal government only moved there from Philadelphia in 1800. This meant that by the time the Cherokee delegation arrived in 1808, the city had only existed for a couple of years, and it was still mostly empty swampland with a smattering of construction sites and brick houses. Its population was just 8,000 residents. But keep in mind that at this point, the Cherokee population had dwindled to around 12 to 15,000 people total, so it was still the most impressive city most of the delegates had ever visited. The Cherokee ambassadors stayed at a boarding house at the foot of a grassy hill filled with grazing sheep. Behind them, a massive white edifice was under construction, which today is the Capitol building. Though it was unfinished, it was certainly the most imposing building that the Ridge had ever seen, with its monumental white marble walls rising out of Capitol Hill. Ambassadors from Indian nations were a common sight in Washington, D.C. in the early 19th century. These ambassadors negotiated individual treaties and relationships with the United States, just as ambassadors of foreign countries do today. These native ambassadors were well aware of the romantic, exotic notions Americans had towards Indians, and they leaned into them. These delegates donned their most impressive formal wear, which made them stand out even more from American men in their conforming fashion of high-waisted pants, ruffled shirts, high collars, top hats, and jackets. The outfits the Indians wore were just as diverse as the Indian nations themselves. Some wore traditional materials, such as buckskin or other animal hides. Others adopted more American material, such as linen and calico, but with bright colors and vivid designs that looked nothing like what Americans wore. Some Indian ambassadors had partially shaved heads and face tattoos. Others wore earrings and head feathers, while others still adopted the American style of haircuts. Wherever they went, these ambassadors drew a crowd and were treated like minor celebrities. Americans stepped aside to allow them to pass first on their walks through the Capitol. At hotel lounges, Americans invited them to drinks and engaged in conversations about life beyond the frontier, a place few of them had ever been. Juxtapose this reception to how white Americans treated Indians on the frontier, where they were regarded as savages, not deserving human dignity, and you get a pretty clear dichotomy on how Americans were able to hold two conflicting views of Indians. On the one hand, they were a noble people of foreign nationality. On the other, they were barbarians, barely above the dignity of a wild animal. These conflicting views of Native people will become embedded in the opposing sides of the Indian Removal Act in the future. But for now, Americans were able to hold this cognitive dissonance without much difficulty. The Cherokee delegation was divided between representatives of upper towns and lower towns, and they were just as divided in Washington, D.C. as they had been back home. But before they could address Jefferson in person, they had to parley with the Secretary of War, Henry Dearborn, who would then pass on the Cherokee concerns to Jefferson himself. This game of telephone must have been frustrating at the time, but the upshot is we finally have written records we can draw upon to understand the motives of each party. While working on this episode, I found a secret letter in the National Archives that the Lower Towns had sent to President Jefferson after Chief Black Fox fell from power but before the delegation had arrived in Washington. In this letter, the Lower Town delegates complained bitterly about the Upper Towns. They wrote that, quote, "our worthless brethren," end quote, orchestrated Black Fox's downfall, and they specifically called out the Ridge by name and said that they hoped Jefferson would, quote, "give him strong, loud talk," end quote. The Lower Town delegation said that 12 Cherokee towns were open to move west, but they wanted Jefferson's assurance that the United States would still finance their relocation and provide protection from the western Indian tribes who would not willingly give up their lands to these new arrivals. According to this Lower Town delegation, Black Fox was overthrown dishonorably by the perfidious Upper Towns. They said that it was the Upper Towns that could not be trusted, and that they were the truly faithful Cherokee carrying out Jefferson's wishes. They ended their letter by asking Jefferson to keep secret their communications, because they did not trust the Upper Towns. The delegation from the Upper Towns held the opposite perspective. They sent their own secret letter to Jefferson, which said that only elderly chiefs stuck in the past supported moving west of the Mississippi. These old chiefs refused to embrace modernity and clung to old-fashioned ways. This letter is one of the few documents we have signed by the Ridge, so I'm going to read a part of it to you because it also explains the position of the Cherokee who wanted to remain on their ancestral lands in their own words. The fact that it's in broken English means we know it wasn't altered by American interlopers. Quote, "The Lower Towns is determined to move. I have already told you the ways of our old chiefs. They are so feeble-minded they soon forget their talks. This is the case with the Lower Towns messengers, but it was their old chiefs that directed them. They are asking you for assistance to move. They are asking you for guns. Your advice has been to us to lay by our guns and go to farming, get hoes, plows, and axes. The young people hold your talks fast, respecting farming and industry. These people that has followed your advice, respecting industry, has now children growing up. They are apt to pursue the example of their parents." End quote. In short, the letter argues that Jefferson should trust the Upper Town faction, because they followed American advice, and they were making great progress in agriculture and industry. They were suspicious of the Lower Towns, but they told Jefferson that they would not put up a fight if some Cherokee chose to move west. But they, the true representatives of the nation, were going to stay put. The Cherokee delegates arrived in Washington, D.C. bitterly divided, but they returned home in surprisingly good spirits. Jefferson had promised the Lower Town ambassadors that if their followers chose to move west, the United States would never bother them again, and they would be forever free to live as they wished. Which, well, we'll see how that turns out. Only a small faction of the Lower Towns ultimately decided to make the voluntary trek west, which strengthened the position of the Upper Towns. With their most hard-headed opponents leaving, the Upper Towns were reassured that the Lower Towns could no longer monopolize political power, and the American annuity paid to the nation would be distributed more fairly. The proposal to divide the nation so that the United States could annex the Upper Towns and grant citizenship to its people never came up again. But in negotiating with Jefferson, he advised the Cherokee to pursue further government reform. Up to this point, each town sent a representative to the National Council, but there was no uniform method for electing representatives. each town kind of did its own thing. Jefferson encouraged the Cherokee to adopt a uniform election process so that council members could be elected fairly and represent the entire people, just like in the United States. Minus women and slaves, of course. Suffrage in the Cherokee Nation, like in America, would be limited to adult males. It's ironic, but just like George Washington before him, Thomas Jefferson encouraged the Cherokee to centralize national authority. This centralization would make the Cherokee better equipped to resist American aggression in the future. Nobody knew this at the time, least of all Jefferson. Like other American leaders, he pursued a contradictory policy that strengthened internal Cherokee governance while encouraging other Cherokee to follow traditional lifestyles and lands far to the west. I mentioned this in previous episodes, but early American presidents had no clear end goal in mind for their Indian populations. They merely hoped that by encouraging Indian tribes to become, quote, civilized, that future generations could come up with a solution that would satisfy everybody. We know this will not be. But for now, the Cherokee celebrated because their internal division had finally healed. At the start of the American Revolution, the lower towns were established, setting up a 3-decade-long schism within the nation. But after the delegates returned from Washington, D.C., the upper and lower towns mended their differences at a national council held in autumn 1809. A collection of chiefs declared, quote, "Friends and brothers, it has now been a long time that we have been much confused and divided in our opinions, but now we have settled our affairs to the satisfaction of both parties and become as one. You will now hear from us not as from the lower towns, nor as from the upper towns, but as from the whole Cherokee Nation," end quote. As part of their government reform efforts, the council appointed an executive committee of 13 men to meet more frequently than the national council did to determine government affairs. And coming in at number 3 on this list of men was a man that everybody agreed had the vision and strength to lead the nation into the future. This man was, of course, the Ridge. Next episode, events far from the Cherokee Nation will plunge the United States and Great Britain into war. That's right, we finally made it to the War of 1812. This will be a turning point in our narrative, as well as in Cherokee and American history. We will finally meet Andrew Jackson, the man who will devote all of his energies into Indian removal. But we will also meet a young man who will go on to surpass the Ridge in the eyes of many of his people, a man who many believe to be the greatest Cherokee in history. This man's name is John Ross. Until then, I would really appreciate it if you could like and review this podcast on your podcast app. I know I say it a lot, but this is the best way for Beautiful Losers to reach a wider audience. And while you're doing that, why not spread the word? Tell your friends about this show and share it on social media. You can find more information, including transcripts, pictures, and maps, on the show's website, beautifullosersofhistory.com. And, as always, you can contact me directly via email at beautifullosersofhistory@gmail.com or on Blue Sky, where my handle is nathanmcdermott.bsky.social. Feel free to let me know if I've made any mistakes or if you want to discuss anything about the show. Beautiful Losers of History is written and narrated by me, Nathan McDermott. Logo design is by Nicole Stallings Blanche. And the theme music and transition sounds are from The Four Seasons by Vivaldi, under a Creative Commons license. Background audio is courtesy of Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. Thanks again, and until next time, this has been Beautiful Losers of History.